Hello, hello. I welcome you all again to History's Great Mysteries, a podcast where I take the greatest unanswered subjects of our past and put them under a microscope for you to decide the answers. The last few episodes have been a ton of fun to research and create, but for the most part, they involved events that have happened, you know, relatively recently in the grand scheme of things. And that's why I thought today we could take a big step back to medieval times and take a look at something that I have personally been enthralled with for years now. So take a second to follow me down the rabbit hole. Imagine to yourself, in front of you, a book, an old and cryptic medieval tome with extensive writing and mystical illustrations throughout its decaying yet historic pages. Now, imagine this book has been passed along through the ages, making its way through ancient castles and churches, in the deepest depths of some of the grandest archives, exchanging hands with some of history's most perplexing and intelligent figures. Even today, it sits in the official Yale Library, where it draws interest from all over the world. Yet, even with all this fame and notoriety, not a single living soul has the slightest idea of what it actually says, or why it was even written in the first place. This is the incredible tale of the Voynich Manuscript. Before I begin the story, I encourage you all to take a quick Google search of the Voynich Manuscript. So it's spelled V-O-Y-N-I-C-H, Voynich Manuscript, so that you can get a good idea of its physical appearance, and it'll be really important as I tell the story. On the outside, it actually looks quite plain. There's like a brown cover, just kind of tattered, that makes up the outside covering of the book. And then there's roughly 240 internal pages made out of medieval calfskin. And it's not all that large, at around 10 inches tall and about 6 inches wide, making it perhaps a bit smaller than your average school textbook, but maybe a bit larger than your favorite paperback novel. And it sounds a bit mundane so far, but it's upon opening the pages where the real mystery begins. Within the sanctified pages, there is extensive writing in some sort of unreadable language, which to me, just solely based on its appearance, kind of looks a bit like Arabic or Hebrew, but with more loops. And the strange writing is accompanied with equally mystifying drawings in and around the margins, sometimes even taking up entire pages and consisting of several different colors. It is generally agreed upon that the manuscript is divided into four separate sections that seemingly have to deal with different subjects. The first pages of the book are referred to as the herbal section due to its recurring illustrations of what appears to be plants and different kinds of foliage. Because of this section, the book has actually been studied by botanists extensively, and strangely enough, and it's important to the story, many agree that while some of these plants do share some characteristics with known species, most of the drawings depict plants that absolutely do not exist anywhere on Earth, at least that we know of. The second section is called the cosmological section because it contains drawings of the sun, moon, stars, and well-known zodiac symbols, along with recurring large circular patterns, which some have pointed to as being drawings of galaxies. But this was a subject that was not understood or accepted in the era that the work was written in, so that's a bit confusing to say the least. The third section is titled the biological section, or the bathing section, in which there's actually a multitude of strange illustrations that depict what appears to be naked women bathing in oddly colored liquid. And this section contains just some of the most head-scratching pictures, with depictions of waterfalls becoming slithering animals of some type, and boats of like confused-looking humans traveling down a stream, just to name a few strange things. And then the fourth section is sometimes split into maybe two smaller sections, but it deals with what it looks like pharmaceuticals or recipes. That's just to say that it contains pictures of roots, some kind of containers, and then there's just long paragraphs of writing. And at this point, you might be asking, well, why can't it be read if there's writing in it? And like I said, this is because it's either written in an unknown language that is lost to us at this point, or it's encrypted, coded in some way. This strange writing is often just referred to as Voynich script, and I'll be calling it that throughout this episode. And its accompanying illustrations are very well constructed, and it's clear to anyone looking at it, and it might be clear to you looking at it if you've looked it up, that someone made this with a compelling purpose in mind. Scholars, amateur sleuths, conspiracy theorists, and skeptics alike have been offering up theories upon theories about what exactly is contained within its pages for over 100 years now. The appearance of its pages just seemed to invite the most creative explanations because, honestly, like, it really just makes your mind race with all the countless and incredible possibilities just because of how crazy it looks, how mystical it looks. And at this point, I'm sure that you as the listener have 100 more questions, as is expected. And many of them can be answered when we take a look at the known history of the Voynich manuscript. The Voynich manuscript got its name when it was purchased in 1912 from a private and secret library in Italy by a man named Wilfred Voynich. Wilfred Voynich was an interesting man, to say the least. He was originally born in 1865 in a portion of Eastern Europe that at that point was occupied by the Russian Empire. In his youth, Voynich devoted himself to his studies, and he became very well educated before eventually joining a Polish revolutionary movement in the mid-1880s. In 1886, he actually attempted a daring rescue mission of several fellow conspirators, in which he was captured by the Russian military and sent to a harsh Siberian prison and work camp for his illegal activities. It was in 1890 that Voynich managed to escape his Siberian prison and fled west, eventually landing in London, where a few years later he settled down a bit, he got married, and he started up a bookshop. Through and through, he was a true bibliophile, and as the years pressed on, his collection of books grew and grew in both size and rarity. He began to make frequent trips into mainland Europe, visiting ancient churches and libraries, purchasing antique books with hopes of reselling them back in England for a profit. This, of course, is how he one day stumbled upon the now famous Voynich manuscript. It appeared as nothing more as nothing special to him upon first glance, but upon opening the first page, his eyes fell upon a note. And on this note, it read as follows: "Reverend Lord, Father in Christ, this book was left to me by a close friend in his will, and ever since I first owned it, I have destined it for you, my dearest Athanasius, persuaded as I am that it can be read by none, if not by you." It goes on to say, "Dr. Raphael, the Czech language tutor of King Ferdinand III, as they both then were, once told me that the said book belonged to Emperor Rudolf, and that he presented 600 ducats to the messenger who brought him the book. He, Raphael, thought that the author was Roger Bacon the Englishman. I suspend my judgment on the matter." Now, don't get lost here. Let me break down everything that I just said. So, this note was written by a man named Johannes Marcy and was sent to a well-known linguist of the time, Athanasius Kircher, in the year 1665. Marcy clearly sent the manuscript along with this note to Kircher in hopes of him being able to read it and unravel its mysteries. The second portion of the letter is a huge help to the modern research community that's dedicated to studying the Voynich manuscript, as it is how we know some of its path throughout the years of history. What Marcy says in this part of the note is that the book once belonged to the Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf, who had paid 600 ducats for it, and I think I'm pronouncing that right, but apparently ducats was the currency used at that time and place. And it's also my understanding that 600 was quite a lot at that time, so it can be presumed that Emperor Rudolf was convinced of its importance and value. Lastly, it is said that perhaps the Englishman Roger Bacon is the author of the manuscript, and Voynich actually tended to agree and lean in this direction during his life. Roger Bacon was actually a well-known historical figure from the 13th century, known as a philosopher, a scientist, linguist, and an alchemist. His intelligence was so ahead of its time that he was actually considered to be a sort of wizard, and it's thought that he was actually the inspiration for the fictional legendary figure Merlin. And I mentioned that Bacon was an alchemist, but his journey into the unknown arts goes even further, even towards the realm of the occult. And it's said that at some point in his life, Bacon constructed a necromantic brazen head, which is a mythical and magical object that was said to correctly answer any question that's asked towards it. So it's understandable that Voynich would easily accept that man as, you know, he's intelligent, he's experienced, and because of his mystical nature, that he could very well be the author of this perplexing manuscript. And furthermore, it's also understandable that Voynich would want to push this authorship because it meant that potential buyers would immediately recognize its historical significance with the name Roger Bacon attached to it. It was in 1921 when Voynich finally came public with the manuscript, presenting it to the College of Physicians in Philadelphia, where he was accompanied by a certain linguistics professor, Newbold, who Voynich believed was the world's best chance at cracking the code. Newbold's attempt at translating the script was marked as the first modern attempt. Newbold spent years with the book and actually ended up publishing his own piece titled The Cipher of Roger Bacon, in which he claimed he completely solved the riddle. However, when scholars attempted to follow his lengthy and complicated multi-step process to translate the words, they can never fully recreate his conclusions or come to any kind of unanimous agreement of proper translations. This is because Newbold's theory hinged on minuscule markings where you'd literally have to take out like a microscope and look at very detailed differences in the ways that each characters are written. And based on these differences, it can change meaning entirely. So as a result, each person that uses Newbold's technique can come to completely different conclusions about each word's decipherment, let alone the entire manuscript as a whole. It was only a few short years later when Newbold's system was discredited entirely, and his professional career and reputation actually took a hard hit after this quote-unquote disgrace. It was such a hard hit, in fact, that he actually never fully recovered his credibility before dying in 1926. This was the first indication that the infamous Voynich manuscript by no means would relinquish its secrets easily. Shortly thereafter, Wilfred Voynich himself passed away at the age of 64 after a bout of pneumonia. Sadly, Voynich left this world without ever receiving any answers, answers which he had devoted his life to unraveling. In his will, he left the manuscript to his wife, who in turn then passed it on among friends, until it eventually landed in the hands of Hans Krauss, a New York book dealer. Hans began marketing the book around the United States, asking for quite a hefty sum. After years of fruitless efforts to sell the book, Hans eventually decided to donate it instead to Yale University, where it has remained to this day. It might be my optimism talking here, but perhaps Hans realized that handing it over to a public university would finally allow the manuscript to leave the private hands and eyes of individuals and finally allow for widespread viewing and research on the encrypted manuscript, which at this point still had no proven author, let alone been fully translated. In 1944, the first study group was assembled by a well-known husband and wife cryptography team, William and Elizabeth Friedman. They, along with several other individuals from a myriad of backgrounds and expertise, took a crack at making a sense of the Voynich manuscript. They made some progress in understanding its layout, and this is about the time that the public could truly find resources and knowledge about the manuscript, and there was a heavy push for answers in the 70s, with research being conducted across all disciplines. Well, I can say, yes, we did get closer to understanding some things about the manuscript. The biggest questions about its contents and its purpose still eluded experts. In 1991, the first mailing list was set up dedicated to an international discussion on the topic. The first Voynich manuscript website was launched in 1998, a website that is still running today and actually offered a large amount of the information used in this podcast. In 2004, the Yale Library released high-quality color scans of each and every page to the web, and that was a big landmark in truly reaching the public. Through these recent efforts, there has been a lot discovered about the nature of its contents. Firstly, work done in 2009 at the University of Arizona reliably carbon dated the pages to sometime between 1404 and 1438, with 95% probability. This is important for several reasons. We finally had convincing knowledge of when it was actually written, along with equally convincing knowledge that it was most likely not Roger Bacon that wrote it. This is simply because Roger Bacon lived in the 13th century, not the 15th century. Going further, the digital copying of the manuscript allowed a whole new game-changing approach to decoding its script, an approach that involved computer algorithms, programs, and statistical analysis. Through this, several important discoveries have been made very recently. The first big question was, okay, this looks like it's purposeful and it looks like some sort of real language, but what if it's actually just gibberish, written down on a page at random, which could maybe explain why it's never been deciphered? Now, this is where things get a bit complicated in the realm of linguistics, but essentially, there's a statistically accepted range of word frequencies in natural language. It's something referred to as Zipf's law and or word entropy that is present in a language like English, you know, Spanish, German, any kind of natural language that is spoken. So, for example, in this podcast, there are words like maybe the word strange that maybe have been used too often, but that have been used a lot. In comparison to words like, I don't know, pudding, that I have now just only used once. And then there are even more common words like and or the. And essentially the frequency of these words in a podcast spoken in English will almost certainly adhere to Zipf's law. And this statistical analysis was conducted to determine if the manuscript also adhered, or in other words, is it actually written in a natural language, or is it just gibberish? And lo and behold, these tests pointed to the manuscript being written in natural language. So, let's look at another program that took hundreds of languages from around the world and ran a complex comparison algorithm to try to find similarity in usages, grammar, etc., in an effort to perhaps narrow down the base language of the script. It actually found that it was most similar to the Chinese language, mostly based on its seeming reliance on syllables to create words. But despite all this computational power, it has not allowed us to actually translate anything. And I can assure you, everything you're thinking about these people, okay, you know, what if they looked into this? What if they looked into this? I can almost guarantee that it's already probably been looked into. Seemingly every avenue that cryptographers and codebreakers usually take to translate this have ultimately failed. For example, one might think, oh, okay, you know, there's sections devoted to specific things, so maybe we can pick out certain words that are unique to those sections, like perhaps the word star in the space section or the word grow in the plant section, and then we can work from there because we now have one word translated. But no, this avenue has led to nothing. So maybe you might think, oh, let's look at the most common words in the natural language, like you, me, etc., and try to determine those in the pages. But no. You might think, oh, okay, well, what are some of the most common words that begin and end sentences? Let's compare those. But again, no, the Voynich manuscript doesn't even have any noticeable punctuation marks, so that would be pretty tough. And even more so, some experts still argue about the direction in which we should read it, right to left to right, bottom to top. Although it is worth saying that most do agree it should be read from left to right, like English. Which is actually in direct contradiction to the Chinese similarities, because Chinese is read from right to left. So here we are in the 21st century with little to no concrete answers about this medieval tome. It is precisely because of this lack of answers that theories upon theories dominate the Voynich manuscript discussions. So settle in, think about what you believe in when it comes to this purpose and its meaning, and allow me to lay out some of the most common explanations for this truly legendary manuscript. The theories on this topic mainly center around five very simple questions, each listed with increasing importance: when, where, who, what, and why. That is, when it was written, where it was written, who wrote it, and what does it say, and then lastly, why. To a certain degree of certainty, we have solved the first question. As I said before, it was most likely written between 1404 and 1438 after we carbon dated the pages. This all but disproves a few of the outlandish theories, one of them being that Wilfred Voynich himself hoaxed the entire thing, and that he's the author who created this very convincing medieval text with hopes of selling it in his bookstore for a steep price to those who believed it. But unless Voynich somehow stumbled upon hundreds of pages of 500-year-old parchment, and also stumbled upon 500-year-old ink, and elaborately constructed the entire story by convincingly fabricating its false history, that, you know, in many ways is impossible, because there are traces of the manuscript appearing in libraries before Voynich was ever even born. So this theory does seem highly unlikely. But anyways, the information about when is widely accepted, and thus this knowledge can actually help us in our efforts to solve the next couple of questions. So the question of where arises. And lucky for us, some clever people along the way have come up with several ways to tackle this consideration. Firstly, special attention was given to the third section of the book that, as you remember, contained pictures of humans, mostly women, some of them naked, as I said, but some of them were clothed, and solely based on the type of clothing, the style, and then the hairstyles that were depicted, it is thought that it had perhaps Southern European origins. This is further accepted when you consider another small drawing of a castle at the bottom of one page that appears to be designed in a manner that was very common in Southern Europe in the Italy area during the 15th century. Of course, however, there are those who have different points, who point at different points of origin, sometimes over on the eastern parts of the continent, when you consider that the Voynich script could possibly have Chinese influence. Obviously, where it was written can radically change the idea of who wrote it, but this is where the theories explaining the manuscript really begin to heat up. So first off, some still do believe that it was Roger Bacon who wrote the book, insisting that the carbon dating is actually just inaccurate. Again, the most solid piece of evidence that we have offering insight into the history of the manuscript was that note that was found in the first page when Wilfred Voynich originally stumbled upon it. In the note, there is some conjecture that, you know, Roger Bacon was the author, but beyond that, Marcy only writes that a messenger of some sort sold the book to Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II. Who this messenger was and where they got it, we may never know. In fact, researchers have spent hours meticulously mapping out the exact known timeline of the book, and while we are pretty certain of its movements beginning with Rudolf in the early 1600s, we are actually, like, kind of have a gap, because, again, it was written in the early 1400s, so there's a 200-year gap where we have no knowledge about its whereabouts. And considering this, it even makes it harder to identify the original author. One semi-popular theory points to the author being a man named John Dee. John Dee was a known occultist who, for lack of a better term, possessed the type of personality that might be needed to write the Voynich manuscript. Furthermore, it is known that Dee spent time in Emperor Rudolf's court, reportedly selling him items from time to time. People have suggested that Dee scribbled down the entire manuscript in an effort to make it look historical and mystical, solely for the purpose of swindling the emperor into buying it for a hefty price. Going even further, his handwriting has been compared to some of the markings in the manuscript, and it's generally accepted that, you know, yeah, there are some similarities. However, we have the problem that if Dee lived in the 1600s with Emperor Rudolf, then how could he have been alive in the 1400s when the book was assumed to have been written? Also, there are detailed reports of all purchases made in Emperor Rudolph's court, with no trace of him ever purchasing any kind of book from Dee for the sum of 600 ducats. Another theory of authorship more recently put forward is of a famous 15th century architect by the name of Filarte, or I hope I'm pronouncing that right. But anyways, this theory was originally put forward by Nick Pelling in his book The Curse of the Voynich, where he argues that this hyper-intelligent Florentine architect is responsible for penning the manuscript. Unlike the other theories, this one actually agrees with the carbon dating, which is important, I think. But from here, lesser-known theories on the who aspect start to take over, offering up authors from all ages and locations that all cannot be definitively proven. So if the who cannot be divulged, perhaps we'll have more luck with the question of what. What is it actually written in those pages? The theories here mainly fall into four categories. One, that the writing is in a lost and unknown language that we have no knowledge of. Two, is that the writing is just complete nonsense and gibberish, but, you know, for reasons we already discussed, this seems somewhat unlikely. Then three, is that the theory of the script being in a constructed language. And then four, that the writing is perhaps encoded, for which we require knowledge about the key or the decoding technique in order to read it. So first, let's hit on the unknown language explanation. I mean, this seems plausible, right? This could be the reason that we have found it not to be gibberish and that it does follow the tendencies of natural language. The problem is that you have to remember that in the grand scheme of things, this book was likely written in the 15th century in heavily populated Europe. We aren't talking about some incredibly, you know, remote, lost language spoken by a small island tribe in 4000 BC or anything like that. Because in that scenario, yeah, there's a very good reason why we might lose that language, you know, on a small island in 4000 BC. But to say that there was a language circulating in Europe during the 1600s that has completely fallen off of the radar is maybe a bit far-fetched. I mean, there are historians and linguists that dedicate their lives to studying past languages, and to date, no one has ever come forward to identify the language of the Voynich script. So, okay. But what has been suggested more than a few times is that the writing is in a mixture of languages, with perhaps use of shorthand notation that would only really be readable by the author who actually wrote it in the first place. This also sounds plausible, but unfortunately, because the specific theory is so vague, there's no real concrete way to prove or disprove it, so we really just have to accept it as a possibility. Second, there is the ever-present it's just gibberish theory, which has some flaws that we've already hit on. But one additional thing that supporters of this theory point to is the fact that in all of the 240-ish pages of the manuscript, there's not a single noticeable mistake or error made anywhere in the script. In the time that it was written, using, you know, ink and pen, it's highly unlikely for someone to write this much in an alternative, unusual script, no less, with no errant marks. If you look at medieval texts, very often you will see, if you talk to a medieval literature historian, you will see error marks all over the place. So people like to point at this and say, well, this is proof that it must all be gibberish because the author had no idea what was being written and felt no need to fix anything. My immediate thought, however, when I read this was that, okay, true, but if whoever wrote this was truly dedicated to creating an intricate and detailed manuscript as it appears to be, then who's to say that when they made these unfortunate errors, they didn't just get a whole new piece of parchment to restart the page? I mean, this makes sense to me if the writer truly wanted the work to be pristine. But think of this as you will. Okay, so third, we have to consider that perhaps the script is written in a constructed language. The Webster-Merriam Dictionary definition for constructed language is an invented language intended for human communication that has planned and cohesive phonological, grammatical, and syntactical systems. So I know you all have encountered this. Imagine the fictional language in movies and shows, like Elvish in Lord of the Rings, or Klingon in Star Trek, or even Wookiee in Star Wars. Each of these languages was invented, thought out, and then used for a purpose with, you know, varying amounts of complexity and depth. This is opposed to natural language, which evolves and morphs through years of widespread usage in the real world. Perhaps even yourselves at one point in your life has taken a crack at inventing your own language, maybe in an effort to have secret conversations with your sibling or just for fun. So the theory goes that whoever wrote the manuscript actually invented their own complex language and used this to fill the pages. Unfortunately, this is considered as more and more of a possibility as we exhaust all other avenues of explanation. But again, there's no real way to prove or disprove it. The only real flaw that I can point out in this theory is simply that it is very possible for constructed languages to be translated. I mean, think about it. Given enough time watching Star Trek without subtitles, anyone could pick up some words here and there. You know, perhaps someone points at a human and says the Klingon word for human, and then you've just picked up on it. So by just simply saying, oh, it must be an invented language, that does not by any means explain why it still eludes any kind of translation. Finally, the fourth option I mentioned was that the script is encoded and that we would need the cipher in order to reveal its true meaning. This is the popular practice of cryptography. I'm sure that here and there everyone has encountered cryptography somewhere in their lives. It's how military communications can be secure even if enemies have access to the communication line. It's how emails can be securely sent across the internet in that basically there is a message that has been encoded and that the only way to read it is by having or figuring out the key to decode it and make the message legible. So, for example, I could encode the lyrics to the song Twinkle Twinkle Little Star by this process. Each letter in the alphabet will become the number it sequentially corresponds to in my code. So A is the number 1, B is the number 2, and so on and so forth. So therefore, I could tell you 20, 23, 9, blah, blah, blah. And then to someone who doesn't know the key, it just sounds like numbers. It means nothing. But to you guys who know the key, you know that I'm spelling out T-W-I, and I'm spelling out the lyrics to Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. So that's just a very basic example of cryptography, but I'm sure you can imagine how complex the whole process can become. I mean, in World War II, the secret code that was developed by the Germans was so difficult for American codebreakers to solve that it literally took the invention of the first computer to break it. We have Alan Turing to thank for that, the father of theoretical computer science. And actually, fun fact, Alan Turing himself, the man who cracked the German code in World War II, also actually attempted to decode the Voynich manuscript, but ultimately got nowhere. But anyways, yeah, cryptography. It is said that perhaps the manuscript is so well encoded that we have just not found out the key to decoding it. This possibility is incredible to me. I mean, think about it. If we're to believe that, you know, you're talking about a 15th century European who created perhaps the absolute best encryption technique, a technique that has stumped the world's most intelligent minds for over half a millennium. And we know for a fact that cryptography was a subject that was not all that popular or advanced back then when, you know, you compare it to cryptography of today. Is it possible that there was some ultra, and I mean ultra intelligent person living in Europe during the 15th century, and all we have of their legacy is this manuscript that could contain incredible information? This is where I will get into the last overarching question, and that is the why. Why was it written? What was the purpose? This is where theories truly get colorful in the most creative of ways, and I encourage all of you as listeners to imagine the countless fun possibilities here. Some like to say that this was an intricate dream journal, documenting pictures and words seen in dreams, which could explain the dreamlike illustrations, and which is also why we as outside sources have no way of translating its real meaning. Some like to say perhaps whoever wrote this had some kind of mental disorder that could explain some of the strange aspects of the book. A more prevailing theory is that it is some kind of medical or scientific journal, containing information on herbal medicines, pharmaceuticals, astrology, and bathing techniques. On the opposite side of that coin, what if it's a journal of alchemy, outlining dark and mysterious fringe experiments in the occult? There, we have already seen several suggested authors that were known to be experimenting alchemists. What if this manuscript could unlock the mysteries of alchemy that was maybe understood back then but has since lost its meaning to history? It would also make sense that if we follow this alchemical line of thinking, that the author would want to keep its contents well hidden from the average eye. So perhaps this is why the script is so well encoded, or perhaps it's just written in a hopelessly complex constructed language to which only a few lone souls were familiar with. Some believe that it depicts the practices of an unknown or lost religion slash cult that was maybe highly secretive and had motive to make the manuscript unreadable. Along the more mundane lines, I've already touched on the possibility that it was created as a hoax, with hopes that there would be a reaction just like we have been, where people are entranced by its mysteries and would in turn pay a large sum of money to perhaps buy it. What if it was just some rich Italian with way too much time on their hands who created the manuscript as a type of experimental art project? What is my opinion? Well, I kid you not when I tell you that I have spent more than a few nights literally lying in bed, staring at the ceiling, mulling over all of the possibilities, trying to land on a theory of what I find to be the most plausible. And after all that, here it is. I believe that the Voynich manuscript was indeed written in the 15th century and was indeed written in Southern Europe, but where my theory gets a bit more sensational is that I believe it was written by a super intelligent person of the sciences, and contained groundbreaking medical advice for those living in the 15th century. When it comes to the actual encryption, you know, I'm not going to lie, I'm way above my pay grade trying to offer a solution in this regard. I am not like a cryptographer in any way, shape, or form. But I do have maybe an idea about why it might be so complex. I like to imagine that the script is written using an evolving encoding technique, meaning with each word or page, the way in which each letter is to be read is constantly changing. This could explain why pages with similar subjects seem to have no commonalities to go off of. For example, going back to the Twinkle Twinkle Little Star encryption that I had earlier, what if I told you that now, based on how many letters were in the last word, you have to multiply that number by all subsequent numbers in the next word, and then the following word you now have to divide instead, and you can see how a technique like this could be hopelessly complex. And why would it be encrypted like this? You know, if it's just some sort of medical journal, why would it be so dedicatedly encrypted like this, you may ask? Well, if we look at the contents, the description of hundreds of different plants and roots and possibly even recipes for pharmaceuticals, we're talking about borderline modern medicine, especially when you consider the bathing section. I'd remembered vaguely from my high school European history class that bathing was actually almost never practiced for medieval Europe. And sure enough, upon further research, it's true that bathing was not really practiced back then. The prevailing belief was that disease could be transmitted easily through water, and so one, of course, should avoid submerging their whole body in water. However, we all obviously know the benefits today of bathing and staying clean, and that it actually prevents disease. So my theory is that this person, whoever it may be, actually had run into some trouble during their life where their incredible knowledge in the medical realm had been so unorthodox that it got them into this trouble. And we've seen this type of thing before where people in mid-century civilizations are cast out, banished, or even burned at the stake for disruptive ideas. So maybe something had happened, or this author was just very afraid of it happening, and they decided that the only safe way to write down this information was to hide it behind layers and layers of an unimaginably complex encryption process, or behind a constructed language, or perhaps even both at the same time. If we're allowing the idea that this individual is crazy intelligent and desperately wants to keep their information safe, then it could explain why the script has still not been translated today. Perhaps the author did not intend to leave this world without divulging the necessary information needed to read it, but something happened along the way. Or what's more, maybe the original author did actually write down the key to reading the Voynich manuscript, but that separate book or page is now missing. It's an unfortunate consideration, to say the least, but let me take it another somber step further. If this author was truly pushing for groundbreaking medical practices that included bathing, think about the difference that this could have made in the world at that time. For example, think about the bubonic plague. Why did the plague wipe out millions across the globe in the past, but today it's hardly ever a problem? Because of bathing. The people of mid-century Europe, for the most part, did not bathe, and that simple fact allowed for the plague to spread mercilessly across the continent. I mean, what if the Great Plague of 1665 could have been avoided? Think of all the lives that could have possibly been saved if the knowledge hidden in the Voynich manuscript was known to the world. And with that, I thank you all for taking the time to listen to my podcast. It truly means a lot to me that I can share incredible tales like this one to people who are interested. People who are constantly questioning the status quo, minds that seek out the toughest of answers. And boy, if you like tough answers, this episode sure packed a punch, I'm sure. Like I said, the Voynich manuscript is still a source of heated and colorful discussions when it comes to its mysteries. If your interest has been piqued, I encourage you to follow the research that is constantly being conducted on this medieval book. Although I will warn you, it does seem like every few months a new source is coming out and claiming that they've cracked the code, but unfortunately these almost always turn out to be false leads or just straight up incorrect translations. But I do maintain a hope that one day, some way somehow, a brilliant mind out there can unlock the 600-year mystery contained within the pages of the infamous Voynich manuscript. As always, I'll be back next Thursday with another episode. So until then, drink your water, get some exercise, and stay inquisitive. I'll see you next time.